Good evening. My name is Elise Adler, and on behalf of our esteemed director, Kent Oliver, I want to say welcome and thank you for coming to our salon at 615 with Donna Tart. We're absolutely thrilled to have her here. I hope that all of you have seen the amazing lineup that we have this fall going into winter. I'm going to say them really quickly, and I have to read them because I can't remember everything here. There are a lot of them. Garrison Keillor, Pat Conroy, Wally Lamb, Ann Patchett, Elizabeth Gilbert, Amy Tan, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Nikki Giovanni, Sue Monk-Kidd, Laura Littman. And now I'll take a breath. So be sure and check the salon at 615.org website. I do want to say, most importantly, that Pat Conroy is going to be at Hume Fog. So most of the authors are here in this location, but on occasion, Ann Patchett is going to be at Ingram Hall. So check the website to be sure that you have the right location. And again, that's salon at 615.org. And I know I see a lot of familiar faces, and so those of you who have been here before understand that this would not happen except for a really strong partnership between the Nashville Public Library, the Nashville Public Library Foundation, Humanities Tennessee, and Parnassus Books, who really bring these incredible authors to us here in Nashville. I want to thank Tim Henderson and Serenity Gerben and the staff from Humanities Tennessee, Ann Padgett, Karen Hayes, and the terrific staff from Parnassus Books, Terry Hughes, who's here, president of the Nashville Public Library Foundation, and her fabulous staff, who really, the foundation, make all of these wonderful programs possible for you. And of course, I want to thank our wonderful Nashville Public Library staff, the best library staff in the whole entire universe, Mike Lusk in the booth, and Beth Deeb, and all the rest. It takes a village. I always say that because it's true. And of course, our wonderful volunteers. And you can give applause for all of those fantastic people. There are not too many rules, but there are a couple. We really want to be respectful of the author. So, no recording of any kind. Please, no flash photography. This would be the best time to turn off your phones. We hate phone solos to interrupt the authors, so that would be great. And also, just as a reminder, Ms. Tart will be signing. She'll read, and then she'll ask questions. And when she's done here on the stage, we will bring her around to sign books. A very important note is that she's only going to sign her new book, The Goldfinch. So please be respectful of that. That's her wishes. So just the new book. If you have not already bought copies for yourself or 50 of your closest friends, Parnassus does have a table conveniently located on the way to the signing table. So be sure and get some. So to introduce our author this evening, we have another very, very special guest. Ann Padgett is a nationally recognized award-winning author. We absolutely claim her as our own, and she's certainly a local hero. I mean, she understood the need for a wonderful bookstore here in Athens of the South, and with Karen Hayes, opened up Parnassus Books. I hope that each and every one of you patronize that store and go there all the time. We're so lucky to have it here. And the other thing I wanted to say about Anne is that Time Magazine noted her as she is on the Time list of the top 100 most influential people in the world. I know she has been for me. So please help me welcome Ann Patchett.
Hi, team. Hi, Judd. In the late summer of 1992, I was 20, hold on.
Was I 27 or 28?
I was 28 years old, as was Donna Tart. I am 3 weeks older. And we were both giving a reading at SEBA, which is the Southeastern Booksellers Association, which was being held in New Orleans that year. And her book, The Secret History, and my book, The Patron Saint of Liars, were both just about to come out at the same time to somewhat different receptions, but, you know, it was still good. And we were giving our first reading together. And I remember sitting in a little auditorium that was smaller than this, and the really nice woman who was sitting next to me, who looked like somebody's grandmother, turned out to be Anne Rice. And I knew, as everybody in the room knew at that moment, that we were witnessing the start of something huge, and not something that would be growing over time, but something that was fully arrived. And the greatest part about that night is that I met the person who wound up being one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. And I have to say, one of the people that I love the most in the world. And the idea, if somebody had said to me, how could you get Donna Tartt to come to Nashville on her pub day? It's today. And she's here. If somebody said, how could you do that? Maybe you should open a bookstore. It would have all been worthwhile for this. And I'll tell you, friends, you will remember this. This thing you're here for right now, when life comes to a close, this will be one of the things that you will look back on and say, oh my God, I was there on the day that The Goldfinch was published. My friend, Donna Tartt.
Well, something I'll remember my whole life is being here tonight. This is our anniversary, Anne. And this is the first time that I've read in America from this novel. So this is my debut, and I can think of no place I'd rather be in the whole world. So it's. I'm going to read, and then I'll take questions afterwards. The part I'm going to read is my hero, who's at this point in the book a little 13-year-old boy. His mother has died in an accident, and he's in a bit of a state of shock, and it's in the middle of the night, and some social workers have come by to get him in the apartment because he's there by himself. The social workers put me in the back seat of their compact car and drove me to a diner downtown near their work, a fake grand place glittering with beveled mirrors and cheap Chinatown chandeliers. Once we were in the booth, both of them on one side, with me facing, they took clipboards and pens from their briefcases and tried to make me eat some breakfast while they sat sipping coffee and asking questions. It was still dark outside. The city was just waking up. I don't remember crying or eating either, though all these years later I can still smell the scrambled eggs they ordered for me. The memory of that heaped plate with the steam coming off it still ties my stomach in knots. The diner was mostly empty. Sleepy busboys unpacked boxes of bagels and muffins from behind the counter. A wan cluster of club kids with smudged eyeliner were huddled in a nearby booth. I remember staring over at them with a desperate, clutching attention. A sweaty boy in a Mandarin jacket, a bedraggled girl with pink streaks in her hair, and also at an old lady in full makeup and a fur coat much too warm for the weather, who was sitting by herself at the counter, eating a slice of apple pie. The social workers, who did everything but shake me and snap their fingers in my face to get my attention, seemed to understand how unwilling I was to absorb what they were trying to tell me. Taking turns, they leaned across the table and repeated what I did not want to hear. My mother was dead. She had been struck in the head by flying debris. She had died instantly. They were sorry to be the ones who broke the news. It was the worst part of their job, but they really, really needed me to understand what had happened. My mother was dead and her body was at New York Hospital. Did I understand? Yes, I said, in the long pause where I realized they were expecting me to say something. Their blunt, insistent use of the words death and dead was impossible to reconcile with their reasonable voices, their polyester business clothes, the Spanish pop music on the radio, and the peppy signs behind the counter. Fresh fruit smoothie, diet delight, try our turkey hamburger. Fritos, said the waiter, appearing at our table, holding aloft a big plate of French fries. Both social workers looked startled. The man of the pair, first names only, Enrique, said something in Spanish and pointed a few tables over where the club kids were gesturing to him. Sitting red-eyed in my shock before my rapidly cooling plate of scrambled eggs, I could scarcely grasp the more practical aspects of my situation. In light of what had happened, their questions about my father seemed so wholly beside the point that I had a hard time understanding why they kept asking so insistently about him. So, when's the last time you saw him? Said the Korean lady, who'd asked me several times to call her by her first name. I've tried and tried to recall it, but I can't. I can still see her plumpish hands folded on the table, though, and the disturbing shade of her nail polish, an ashen, silvery color, something between lavender and blue. A guesstimate? Prompted the man Enrique. About your dad? Ballpark will do, the Korean lady said. When do you think you last saw him? It was an effort to think. Sometime last fall? My mother's death still seemed like a mistake that might be straightened out somehow if I pulled myself together and cooperated with these people. October? September, she said gently when I didn't respond. My head hurt so badly I felt like crying whenever I turned it, although my headache was the least of my problems. I don't know, I said, after school started. September, would you say then? Asked Enrique, glancing up as he made a note on his clipboard. He was a tough-looking guy, uneasy in his suit and tie, like a sports coach gone to fat. But his tone conveyed a reassuring sense of the 9-to-5 world, office filing systems, industrial carpeting, business as usual in the borough of Manhattan. No contact or communication since then? Who's a buddy or close friend who might know how to reach him? Said the Korean lady, leaning forward in a motherly way. The question startled me. I didn't know of any such person. Even the suggestion that my father had close friends, much less buddies, conveyed a misunderstanding of his personality so profound I didn't know how to respond. It was only after the plates had been taken away, in the edgy lull after the meal was finished, but no one was getting up to leave, that it crashed down on me all at once where all their seemingly irrelevant questions about my father and my Decker grandparents in Maryland, I couldn't remember the town, some semi-rural subdivision behind a Home Depot, and my non-existent aunts and uncles had been so plainly leading. I was a minor child without a guardian. I was to be removed immediately from my home, or the environment, as they kept calling it. Until my father's parents were contacted, the city would be stepping in. But what are you going to do with me? I asked for the second time, pushing back in my chair, a crackle of panic rising in my voice. It had all seemed very informal when I'd turned off the television and left the apartment with them for a bite to eat, as they'd said. Nobody had said a word about removing me from my home. Enrique glanced down at his clipboard. Well, Teo, he kept pronouncing it Teo, they both did, which was wrong. You're a minor child in need of immediate care. We're going to need to place you in some kind of emergency custody. Custody? The word made my stomach crawl. It suggested courtrooms, locked dormitories, basketball courts ringed with barbed wire fence. Well, let's say care then. And only until your grandma and grandpa... Wait, I said, overwhelmed at exactly how fast things were spinning out of control, at the false assumption of warmth and familiarity in the way he'd said the words grandma and grandpa. We'll just need to make some temporary arrangements until we reach them, said the Korean lady, leaning close. Her breath smelled minty, but also had the slightest underbite of garlic. We know how sad you must be, but there's nothing to worry about. Our job is just to keep you safe until we reach the people who love you and care about you, okay? It was too awful to be real. I stared at the two strange faces across the booth, sallow in the artificial lights. Even the proposition that Grandpa Decker and Dorothy were people who cared about me was absurd. But what's going to happen to me, I said. The main concern, said Enrique, is that you're in a capable foster situation for the time being, with someone that'll work hand in hand with social services to implement your care plan. Their combined efforts to soothe me, their calm voices and sympathetic, reasonable expressions, made me increasingly frantic. Stop it, I said, jerking away from the Korean lady who had reached over across the table and was attempting to clasp my hand in a caring way. Look, Teo, let me explain something. Nobody's talking about detention or a juvenile facility. Then what? Temporary custody. All that means is we take you to a safe place with people who will act as guardians for the state. What if I don't want to go, I said. Provisional approval, especially in a situation like yours. What he's saying? The Korean lady tapped her fingernail on the formica to get my attention. It's not set in stone if you go into the system, if there's somebody who can come stay with you for a little while, or vice versa. A little while, I repeated. It was the only part of the sentence that had sunk in. Like, maybe there's somebody else we could call that you might be comfortable staying with for a day or two? Like a teacher, maybe. Or a family friend. Off the top of my head, I gave them the telephone number of my old friend Andy Barber, the first number that came to me, maybe because it was the first phone number beside my own I'd learned by heart. Though Andy and I had been good friends in elementary school, movies, sleepovers, summer classes in Central Park, and map and compass skills, I'm still not quite sure why his name was the first to fall out of my mouth, since we weren't such good friends anymore. We'd drifted apart at the start of junior high. I'd hardly seen him in months. Barber with a U, said Enrique as he wrote the name down. Who are these people? Friends? Yes, I replied. I'd known them all my life, practically. The Barbers lived on Park Avenue. Andy had been my best friend since third grade. His dad has a big job on Wall Street, I said, and then I shut up. It had just occurred to me that Andy's dad had spent some unknown amount of time in a Connecticut mental hospital for exhaustion. What about the mother? Two reasons, why? Yeah.
Who are some of the great writers that you feel have influenced you in your writing?
Who are some of the great writers who have influenced me in my writing? A lot. The first writer I really loved Robert Louis Stevenson when I was a little girl. Really loved him. Read Treasure Island just over. And so the premiere of my book was in Holland, in Dutch language. But the Dutch were very interested in this because, of course, they were thinking about Theo van Gogh's brother, you know, and I think there is something to that, I think, because the Theo in my book is, he's not an artist himself, but he sees himself as kind of a custodian of art, which is a duty that he carries out indifferently at best sometimes, but that is how he sees himself. And so I think that was probably in the back of my mind, something that a Dutch reporter pointed out to me too that I didn't see or think of at all. But Theo Decker Dana Tart, he said that, and he was like TDDT, same number of letters, and I thought, I didn't do that. I didn't do that on purpose. I really didn't. I did not do that. But nonetheless, it's there. And when you ask me a question like that, I don't know. But I was surprised when he pointed that out. But yeah, I don't know. It was nothing I did on purpose. But yeah, he does have inverse of my initials. So anyway. That's all I have to say about Theo's name. Yes?
I went and saw this painting at the High Museum in Atlanta.
Oh, good for you. Yeah,
well, and it was great because then the stories about your book came out. And I was like, oh, I've seen that painting. So I wondered what your relationship is with that painting and how you chose it for the book.
I first saw that painting as a copy in Christie's Amsterdam, a 19th century copy, and a really pretty good 19th century copy. And I liked it even as a copy. I thought it was it's a wonderful, wonderful little painting, and it's really tiny. I actually saw it yesterday. The show just opened in New York and I went to it. But it's very small. And if you saw it in the room, I mean, there are all those big Dutch paintings, and there's this tiny little thing. It's very different looking. It's really an anomaly. It's like nothing from that age of art. But it's very interesting to write about Fabricius because he was a very great painter and very celebrated in his own day, but he was the pupil of Rembrandt, and he was Rembrandt's most famous pupil. Rembrandt was extremely famous in his own day. Rembrandt was famous from the time he was about 25 years old until this very night. He started painting, and we've known his name ever since. But and Fabricius was his most famous pupil. I mean, and this is in an age when painters greatly valued, and he was very, very highly thought of. But he died very young in a sort of a terrible accident. The gunpowder factory exploded in Delft in 1654, and it blew up half the city, and it destroyed just countless amounts of art, but it also killed Fabricius and destroyed most of his work. Vermeer lived in Delft. Vermeer was Fabricius's pupil. Insofar as we really know Fabricius's work very much at all, it's through his influence on Vermeer. If you put Vermeer and Fabricius side by side, you can see the kinship between them and Rembrandt and Fabricius. But if you look at Rembrandt and Vermeer, you think, what's these two painters don't look anything like each other. Fabricius used all sort of Rembrandt's great sort of impasto quality, sort of piling on the paint, very, very thick. Also really good at illusionistic effects, but he's not dark like Rembrandt is. It's light. It's sunlight. That bird is against a sunny, bright wall. You don't really have quite that quality of light in Dutch art. We know it through Vermeer because that, insofar as we know Fabricius's work, it's really through Vermeer, who wasn't famous in his own day either. I mean, who became famous in the 1890s, really. His work was really rediscovered. But Fabricius was so wonderful to, it was interesting to write a book. I have people asking me all the time, is this a real painting? That they think I made the painting up because it's not really very famous. There are only maybe half a dozen paintings of Fabricius that survived. They're rare, the rarest of the rare. And of them, the Goldfinch is the greatest one. And it makes you wonder what the rest of his work looked like. But in a way, the fact that the painting is so little known outside Holland, it's very famous in Holland, but not quite so famous everywhere else, it was almost like I was writing about some mythical painter in a Borges story. You know, he could almost be imaginary because it would have been much harder to write a book and much less appealing to me about a great name that was more widely known. I mean, there's a sort of ghostly quality about him that made it interesting for me to and Fabricius himself really appears kind of as a ghost through the book, and as not a literal ghost but a figurative ghost, and he's there until the very end. I mean, Theo is a bit haunted by him and haunted by this story, and that story is sort of a running counter to his own story throughout the book. Yes?
Since it's a long time between books for you, would you tell us a little bit about the process? Does the concept come, or do you struggle with the concept and then the book comes quickly, or do you go through a lot of rewrites? It's sort of the process of your writing.
I write a lot. I write by hand, first of all, and I write a lot. I keep notebooks, and even though I write a lot, not everything that I write ends up in a finished book. I think it was Brahms who said, composition is easy. What's hard is having to throw most of what you write away. I began taking notes for this, what I didn't know it was this book, but I started writing about Amsterdam 1993, about 20 years ago. And some of the Amsterdam portions of this book were written as long ago as 20 years ago. But I didn't have any idea that they would be part of a novel someday, part of a finished novel. I have lots of things like that in notebooks that don't actually wind up becoming books. But lots of different things came together in just the right way. There wasn't one idea that everything came together. I mean, something that was actually at the bottom of it, and I can't say why exactly, but it had to do with my the fact that I think that I wrote something about art and the destruction of art was when the great Buddhas at Bamiyan were destroyed before 9/11. That was it was the thing that happened before 9/11 that was slightly the precursor to 9/11, the sort of pre-shock before 9/11. And incredibly, I can't say why that really was the event. I don't know why it came out, the story came out, why that was the germ of what made me write this story. In a funny way, I mean, I work so much from my unconscious that I don't really question why I write what I write too much. I think it's not always a very good idea, but I do know that it's not a good idea for me to analyze it. In a way, because I don't analyze it, it comes out in fiction. That's where the impulse to write fiction comes from, is from not analyzing it, and then it processes itself, and it comes out in a novel. But definitely that was the thing. That's the reason this is a book about art, and it's not a book about law or a book about medicine or about music. That was the catalyst. That was the thing. Yes? No. I think somebody was scratching their nose back there. Hi. A comfort with?
I wouldn't say comfort, but like an understanding sort of ease. It wasn't like in the chain of events that lead to it.
Well, what I was hoping to do in The Secret History, I was hoping that the reader would identify with the narrator to some extent, and to some extent be making those choices along with the narrator. And then all of a sudden to look up and, where am I? What have I done? You know, it was a way of, because it was, there wasn't in The Secret History, and it often happens that way with evil and with evil acts, that there's a great book written by Gita Sereny called Into That Darkness. She interviewed a concentration camp commandant named Franz Stangl about who was caught later on, and he really talked to her. He told the truth about what he did and why he did it. And the chilling thing about it is, just at some point he looked up and I'm just in something I didn't understand. Just how slowly it happened it's the old Al Gore metaphor of the frog being boiled to death, the frog in a pan of water, and it just keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and then the frog just doesn't realize it until it's too late. But Yeah, with Franz Stangl, it was very interesting because the first thing they asked him to do, he was a Catholic, first thing they asked him to do, well, you're a member of the Nazi party, you have to sort of renounce the Catholic faith. And he didn't really want to do it, but it was his job, and he did it. And it just little thing like that after little thing, and just it you know, wound up being something horrible. But it's about those, really, it's about those tiny decisions across along the way, because they're actually all important. You know, even the ones that don't seem important, they are. I'll take one more question. Yes. Very, very strongly. Very strongly. All my books, in some sense, really began with place, with a sense of place. Even with my first book, The Secret History, before I really had an idea of the secret history, it really began very much with mood, with being away at school, a strange, snowy place, the feel of certain, you know, empty white rooms, and it was ink stains on my hands and smell of damp wool and just a lot of very sensory impressions of that place and of the newness of it, the strangeness of it. That was, and actually something I have in common with my Bennington classmate, Brett Easton Ellis. I mean, because that, when we started out writing together, we started writing our books about the same time, we were about the same age, and Less Than Zero is that, too. Less Than Zero is all about place. It's all about California. It's a certain sort of sun-blinded California mood. It was, that book really came out of mood, too. But that's certainly true of The Little Friend, of my second book, my Mississippi book, and yes, with this book, before I had any story at all, I was very captivated with sort of a dark Amsterdam mood on the one hand, but on the other, a kind of creepy Park Avenue, a very sort of stale, claustrophobic, rich, sort of spoiled kind of Park Avenue mood. And New York, New Amsterdam, those were the two poles of the novel, Amsterdam and New York. But it wasn't quite hanging together, and I didn't know why. The book wasn't working, and I'd written for 2 or 3 years, and it was oddly a chance trip to Las Vegas that I didn't really particularly want to take. That it's really good that I did. It was a good lesson that you should sometimes do the things that you think that you won't enjoy, because that's actually the thing that will make all the difference. I was walking through a casino, and I saw an exhibition of paintings. They have real paintings there, you know, the exhibition of... It's such an interesting thing, because so much in everything in Las Vegas is fake. There's the Eiffel Tower, and there's, you know, right next door to the Grand Canal that smells like chlorine water, and the canal is on the second floor. Gondoliers, it is. And then you can see the pyramids from the window in New York, New York, Street. Everything is fake, and the disorientation of being in that desert landscape where just all these sorts of bits and broken pieces of civilization kind of all jammed up together, but really all wrong.